And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. They are two simple letters, AI, but they strike a great deal of fear into the hearts of a whole lot of people. AI, of course, referring to artificial intelligence. It is a technological breakthrough that inspires fear and also tremendous excitement. And sometimes those two emotions very much tangled up in one another, because there are extraordinary possibilities offered by artificial intelligence. Even at this relatively early stage of the game, there is much that remains to be developed and understood about artificial intelligence, as well as the wisest way to utilize it in our world and in our lives. But one of the things that we obviously still need to come to grips with is what this is and how it relates to our own human intelligence. That is, the relationship between artificial intelligence and human intelligence. And perhaps if we better understand the nature of our own intelligence, we will be able to better understand artificial intelligence and its full potential. That's just some of what is explored in an incredibly fascinating new book called A Brief History of Intelligence: Evolution, AI, and the Five Breakthroughs That Made Our Brains. The author of the book is Max S. Bennett, who knows a great deal about AI or artificial intelligence. He is co-founder and CEO of Albi, which is an AI startup that helps companies incorporate a certain kind of AI into what they do. Also the co-founder and CPO of Bluecore, a well-known large AI startup from a few years back. In this particular book, which in a sense was created with extensive collaboration with lots of other experts, Max Bennett seeks to help us understand the evolution of the human brain, the evolution, if you will, of our own intelligence. How has our intelligence come to be developed over the millennia? And by understanding that evolution and better understanding the nature of our intelligence, he believes that we can better come to grips with the whole nature of artificial intelligence and what it might mean for our world and our lives. This book is published by Mariner Books. And Max S. Bennett, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
You write at some point in the book, "I wrote this book because I wanted to read this book." That might be my favorite line in the whole book. And and in some ways, it doesn't need explanation. But nevertheless, I really want to hear a little bit more about what is behind those intriguing words.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not a classically trained neuroscientist or roboticist. I'm someone whose career has been based on applying AI technologies in commercial settings, so building technology companies around applying AI to solve real-world problems. And so I've always been a voracious reader of neuroscience, psychology, and AI books. And over the last sort of decade of building tech companies around AI, I felt like there was this missing gap in the intersection between neuroscience and AI. There's always been a very tenuous relationship between those two fields. In the 50s, there was a lot of excitement around AI, obviously. And there was this sort of debate between, should we try and build AI systems in neuromorphic ways, in other words, in ways that are similar to our understanding of how the brain works? And then there's always been another camp that says, let's ignore that entirely. Let's just build AI from first principles. And we've always gone back and forth, but we're in this phase now where there's largely a casting away of trying to build AI systems in human-like ways and trying to understand how the brain works. And I found, you know, I felt like there was a missing gap in books that really bridged the gap between these two things. And for me, I became really fascinated with how our brains came to be. because to me, I'm always interested in like, what are simplifying frameworks we can find to help us make sense of things that are really complicated? You know, I think in business, people do this all the time. And the brain is just really complicated. I mean, I've read many, you know, brain textbooks, and if you want a simple summary of what we understand about the brain, without doing a lot of work, the simple answer would be we just have no idea how it works. Of course, the more complicated answer is much more interesting, but that would be a very simple way to think about it. And the reason is because the brain is so complicated. There's 86 billion neurons in your brain, 100 trillion connections. Just to conceptualize how much of a tangled mess the brain is, within the width of a single letter on a penny, so visualize a penny and then the letters writing on the penny, within that width of your brain, a little slice of your brain, there are over a billion different connections. So wow. It's just such a mess. And evolution designs brains in really messy ways, right? So evolution doesn't design systems in a coherent fashion that a human designer would use. Evolution just sort of tinkers with things over time. So when we look into brains, there's redundant systems, there's overlapping systems, the same process is done in multiple ways. So it's not easy to reverse engineer how it works. So I became like almost a degree of like utter fascination with this idea of, well, what if we could just roll back the clock? What if we could watch the brain evolve? So imagine being in a movie theater and we would be like, okay, what if we could roll back time and go back to the very first brain and just watch the brain evolve and see what intellectual faculties emerge at each milestone in brain evolution? Surely that would make it much easier to understand the complexity that eventually came to be in the human brain. Similarly, if an alien came down and wanted to reverse engineer a MacBook Pro, if we just gave them a MacBook Pro, it'd be really hard for them to understand how it works. But if we gave them a computer museum and they could sort of track the history of computation and how we got to a MacBook Pro, a lot of it would make sense. So I became like really obsessed with this, and there just wasn't a book about it. There was no one who had sort of put together this story that a lot of scientists had done the research on, but had never been pieced together into a story. So I spent half a decade collaborating with evolutionary neuroscientists and psychologists, and I published a few papers on it just to get feedback on the ideas from real scientists. And this is sort of the magnum opus of that research. So yeah, I wanted to read it, and because it didn't exist, I just became obsessed with it. And through crazy happenstances, eventually wrote the book.
Right. And you characterize it at one point, a synthesis of the work of many others. I mean, and they are, of course, quoted at length. And I also want to say that this is complicated stuff, but you do a remarkable job of writing about it in a way that is accessible even to those of us who were double majors in music and religion, for instance, and tended not to go near the world of this kind of science. So anyway, I just found the book surprisingly accessible, and I appreciate that. As somebody who has to read a whole lot of books for this job, I appreciated that this book could be penetrated without too much trouble, especially given how complicated it all is. I guess my eyes lit up in the introduction when one of the first things you write about, of all things, is the wonderful old animated show The Jetsons, which a lot of us grew up watching back in the 1960s. I think you're way too young to have remembered it, but I remember watching The Jetsons when it originally aired. And you talk about how that wonderful, fanciful, entertaining show actually predicted a remarkable amount of what has in fact come to be in our daily lives, with the exception of the character of Rosie the Robot, this mechanical maid in the Jetson household. And you talk about how Rosie the Robot had the intelligence of a human, not just reasoning, common sense, and motor skills needed to perform complex tasks in the physical world, but also the empathizing, perspective taking, and social finesse needed to successfully navigate our social world. I mean, Rosie the Robot on the Jetsons could do all of that. And you go on to say, we still don't have anything like Rosie the Robot. I mean, for all the amazing breakthroughs that we have achieved, we're not there yet, not by a long shot. I'm just curious, why you thought this was the right place to begin the introduction of your book.
So, well, first, thank you for the kind words. It means a lot. I appreciate it. I think it's really interesting to zoom out on a lot of these big technological advancements because it's very easy to get caught up in the hype of the day. So I could have started the book with the most, you know, modern hyped AI technology like ChatGPT. You know, if it was 5 years ago, it would have been computer vision systems. But I think it's useful to take a step back and say, what are we really trying to achieve here? What's the goal of all of this? And how far are we on this this path of what we're trying to do? And there are, of course, there's not alignment on what the overall objective is of AI. I think you'll get different answers from different people you ask. But I think zooming out all the way back to the 60s, when we envisioned this utopic future of technology, and asking, you know, how far towards this future are we, is a really interesting way to sort of lay the foundation of our progress. And I think Rosie is a great example because she really is a recapitulation of human intelligence in a robot. And despite all the hype around AI, a lot of the things that presumably we think are easy for humans to do, right? It's unconscious for us to infer what we mean when we talk to each other. It's unconscious for us to do our dishes, to navigate to work, to drive our cars. These aren't things we think of as crowning achievements of human intellect. But these are the things that we've been utterly unable to recreate in AI systems. It's exactly those things that humans find easy, so easy that they're unconscious, that are the things that brains are really, really good at that we don't fully understand. So I just love the idea of starting with Rosie because, you know, she does two fundamental things that we don't understand in AI, and that goes back to two breakthroughs in brain evolution. One is this ability to have common sense, to move around in the world, to simulate things, and we'll, I'm sure, talk more about that. So that's her ability to just do dishes, to move, to plan her routes as she's walking around. But the second really crucial one that's not talked about enough in AI is the ability to understand human emotion, to infer what we mean by what we say. And that's where her sort of navigation of our social world comes in. And we really need those two things if we're going to want to live alongside AI systems, or if we just want AI systems to solve more practical problems in the world. I just thought Rosie was a great sort of marker for where we're trying to get and how far we are from there.
Fantastic. And yes, I'm glad you mentioned the thing that I had never really stopped to think about, but you say at one point in this portion of the introduction, the first company that builds a robot that can simply load a dishwasher will have one of the best-selling products of all time, because you go on to say all attempts to do this have failed. It's not a mechanical problem. It's an intellectual problem. And I think you're so right that, you know, for those of us who do the dishes on at least a semi-regular basis, we would never think of it as an overly complicated intellectual problem. But in fact, it apparently is.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you don't, it doesn't feel like we're, I mean, there's something called Moravec's paradox. And Moravec was a computer scientist out of Carnegie Mellon. He came up with this in the 80s, which is this idea that the things that are easy for humans are really hard for computers, and the things that are hard for humans are really easy for computers. And so we tend to imbue the things that are hard for humans as the things that are the most impressive. So, you know, doing math in your head is something that we're really impressed by. Humans that can do that, but of course, $2 calculators can do that really easily. But when you do the dishwasher, when you do the dishes, your ability to real-time look at a scrambled mess of dishes in the sink and exactly decide the order in which you're going to pick them up, how you're going to hold each plate, how the exact strength of your grip, how you're going to orient it as you place it into the loading tray, and as you organize it over time, that is a crazy task that is so easy for you, but we still struggle to get robots to do this. They make mistakes, they break the dishes, they don't plan it correctly. So there's a lot of people working on it, but it's something that mammals, I mean, this is not a uniquely human task. Just look at a squirrel running across tree branch. It plans its routes. It can pick up nuts. It can crack them open. It has the motor dexterity that surpasses any AI system we've built. Look at a cat navigate. There's really funny experiments. People have posted this on Twitter, just comparing cat intelligence to AI. And if you create a little maze to try and get a cat to jump over these obstacles without knocking into anything, they do it in one shot effortlessly. And we have no robot that could do anything similar. Mm.
This brings to mind an interesting point made also in the introduction to the book. When you write this, along this journey, as AI keeps getting smarter, it's becoming less clear how to even measure our progress towards this goal. This goal, you know, being AI that would equate something like Rosie the Riveter, or Rosie the robot. This idea that sometimes when AI can do something, what exactly that means, and to kind of measure the significance of that breakthrough, is in and of itself really tricky. Explain more about that trickiness, that matter of measuring AI and exactly what a given breakthrough really means.
Such a good question. I think it's actually one of the most profound questions we have to ask in this coming decade. I don't like making predictions, but here's a prediction I will make publicly here. In the next 10 years, probably within that, we're going to have an AI system that when you talk to it, it answers every question almost as well, or if not better than a human. We're going to be able to talk to it, and it will seem exactly as smart as a human. And when that happens, we're all going to sit back and ask, is this human-like intelligence? Is it sentient? Is it conscious? And we're not going to know how to answer that question. And that's going to be a really challenging situation because it's effectively a measurement problem, which is, well, how do we even know whether what we're talking to does have the properties of the human brain? And the only way we're going to be able to answer that is by looking into how it actually works. And I think this is a really key sort of outstanding hidden challenge in AI that society has to reckon with, which is today we evaluate AI systems only on their performance. We don't really care per se about how they work. So if an AI system can drive your car, then we say, okay, it can drive a car, and we don't really care about how it's pulling it off. But as things get better and better, we're going to have to care a lot about how it works, because the differences and how it works and how the human brain works is going to have big consequences for what we'll trust these systems to do. So for example, we now have, I'll give you some more specific examples of where this really matters. We have an AI system that can pass the bar exam already. ChatGPT passes the bar exam better than lawyers. And yet I would be hard pressed to find a single person that would say we should let ChatGPT be a lawyer. But on what grounds do we deem that we don't trust it? We just don't feel like it's trustworthy, even though the performance metric shows that it clearly does perform well. And the reason is because we know that there's more to the law than is present in the bar exam. So 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was easy to find tests that AI systems didn't perform well on. And so it was easy for us to say the AI is clearly not as smart as us. But as it gets better and better, we're entering this messy ground where we need to be really specific on what we need to see before we trust them. So here's three, and the answer lives in understanding how the systems actually work. And this is why I think understanding the brain and understanding the actual mechanisms by which intelligence emerges is going to be really crucial. And I'll give you a little case study that I think is really instructive. I'll give you three scenarios of a AI system that passes the bar exam. The performance will be identical. It gets perfect score, but the three cases will be very different. Case one, I give the AI system the answers to the exact same bar exam it's gonna take. So I train it on the test with the right answers, and then it gets a perfect score. In that scenario, we are not impressed at all because it clearly just cheated. We know that it's not gonna be able to answer law questions in new scenarios. So performance 100%, our trust is 0%. The only way we knew that it was 0% was because we learned how it actually was trained. Scenario two, we trained the AI system on all the previous bar exams with the right answers, but not this one, and it gets 100%. That's more impressive, but we still wouldn't trust that AI system to be a lawyer because we know that bar exams don't contain all the information necessary to be a good lawyer. So we know for a fact it hasn't been given the information necessary to be a good lawyer. Scenario three, it never took a bar exam in its life. It only just read legal briefs and law textbooks, and then it gets 100%. So in all three of these cases, the performance, the measurement is identical, but they clearly mean different things in which system we're going to trust more. Scenario three, we're going to trust the most because its performance is the most divergent from its training data. And so this has big implications for AI regulation, where we can't just take these systems and test them. We really need to know what they were trained on and how they work before we can trust them. So long-winded way of just of saying that as performance gets better, we're entering this gray area where we can be easily hoodwinked into thinking things are as smart as humans, and only when we look under the hood do we see the ways in which they're actually not doing what we want them to do in order for us to trust them. There's one final example, and then I'll mm-hmm. end the answer. In I think it was the 60s. Where someone built a chatbot called Eliza. I forget the exact decade, but I think it was the 60s. And it tricked certain users into thinking they were talking to a person. It passed the famous Turing test, which is you're just talking to a chatbot. And it obviously wasn't a human, but you asked the users, do you think you're talking to a human? And some people were tricked into thinking so. But what did it do? Literally all the system did is it asked the questions back to the user. So if it was meant to be a little therapist. So if I said, hey, I'm depressed, it would say, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Why are you depressed? And it just played back the same thing. And so with that very simple rule of just take the statement that a user says and play it back as a question, people got tricked. And so that's a performance measure where people say, I believe I'm talking to a human. But when you look under the hood, you realize they were just hoodwinked. And so we need to know how these systems actually work before we trust them.
Right. I wasn't going to ask this. The question just occurred to me now. If I can, this might seem sort of like a personal question maybe, or maybe a bit too specific, but I'm just curious, for instance, with your current AI company, Albi, for instance, within the ranks of those who work with you and for you, how much wrestling with some of these kind of questions occurs? And do you find that there is a significant difference in perspective depending on what aspect of this a given person is working on?
Yeah, really good question. We definitely wrestle with this on two grounds. One ground is when you're actually applying these AI systems to real-world problems, the performance metrics really matter, and the subtle ways in which these systems are not as smart as humans reveal themselves. So it's one thing to create a really nice demo, but when you're actually trying to solve a real-world problem, in other words, help a company actually create a better experience for their customers, as an example, and you look at how the AI system performs, we start seeing all the ways in which even these really powerful large language models still fail to fulfill the needs of a human. And that we wrestle with just on a performance basis all the time. And then we try and find what are applications of this technology that are still useful despite the fact that it's not as smart as a human, or what are situations in which it can be useful even though we know it's going to make mistakes more than a human would. So that's just the practical application that we definitely wrestle with. The other one is an ethical question, which is for any company that's applying AI systems, I think we have to ask, what are the ethical implications of people being confused and thinking it's an AI? Like, for example, you know, we have a principle where we'll always be transparent when you're talking to an AI system instead of a human. That's a really important principle. Another ethical question is, if you're training, like we're not working on mental health applications, but suppose you were, how do you make sure that the places where it makes mistakes don't lead to real harm, right? So really powerful demos make people think something safe when it might not be safe. And I think it behooves those that are building AI systems to go to undue effort to make sure that these edge cases are accounted for. And even though the system seems really good, if it actually makes mistakes in unpredictable ways, it's on the builders to raise their hand and say, this is not ready yet, right? And I think that's where a really loud critique of the AI community now, which I think is totally legitimate, is we're rolling these things out really fast because there's this AI arms race. And we're not asking the question of what are the applications in which this is actually safe to use. So, yeah, we definitely wrestle with this on a very regular basis.
Right. And I guess just to follow up on that question, your answer was fascinating. When you are wrestling, when you say we are wrestling, I just wonder if it's simplistic to say that there are some of you who are really caught up in some of these ethical questions, while there are others who are, in a sense, so busy with the doing, with, in a sense, creating that breakthrough itself, that for somebody like that, they are less inclined, less apt to be caught up in some of those ethical dilemmas and questions that are raised. Or is that simplistic? I mean, is this, are at least at your company, that's all I'm asking you to speak for, is this wrestling really occurring with all of you? I mean, are all of you wrestling with this in roughly the same way?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, I think this is why we have regulatory systems where we don't have to rely on, individual corporate entities to act in good faith like we hope everyone does, but we need regulatory systems to get ahead of this. You know, we made society, I think, failed with social media platforms. We kind of just let it. We played the game of let's see how it unfolds and then regulate it post hoc. And I think most people would agree that was a mistake. We should have been measuring what's the performance on what's the impact on mental health, what's the impact on misinformation earlier, instead of now there's this beast that is really hard to wrangle. I do think society is doing a better job with AI. Before these systems are being rolled out, there's a lot of talk. People are nervous. People want to make sure we do this right. And I think that's a really good thing. I think that, I'm not a fear monger. I'm very optimistic about the future, but I do think some sense of fear can be good that can be channeled into making sure we're thoughtful and to tame an emerging AI arms race to make sure we do things right. So I think that's a really good thing. I think if anyone's in a leadership position, I think they are accountable to bringing up these types of questions because otherwise, I think you're right, it's very easy to get caught up in just the really interesting intellectual problem of the day without thinking about the broader consequences. And this is not just a problem with AI, this is a problem with, technology in general. I mean, I think the most popular recent example is the new movie Oppenheimer, right? People were so caught up in let's just build the bomb, let's build a nuclear bomb. It was such an interesting technological question, challenge, physics feat. And only after the fact did some people pause and go, what did we just create? I think it takes a lot of foresight to pause and ask, are we doing things in the right way?
Right. And I just want to add parenthetically, as you are talking in the introduction about, how we assess what a lot of this means, I think one of the real-world examples that leapt out at me, in part because it's rather antiquated compared to a lot of other things you talk about, is when it comes to something like a calculator, just a really basic calculator, that calculator can do things, in a sense, faster and better than a person can with paper and pencil. But that doesn't mean that calculator understands math. It can do math, but it doesn't necessarily understand math or grasp the concept of of what math is. And I think part of the opening of your book is kind of about that difference or that distinction. And is it a distinction that particularly matters? And if so, in what ways does it matter?
Totally. Yeah, it goes back to that performance question, which is, I think someone in 100 years will write a reflection on, what's happened since the Industrial Revolution and the creation of AI and all of that. And I think one big trend that will be interesting to observe is since the invention of computation, there's been this methodical capitulation of things that previously only humans could do to things that machines could do. And at each step of the way, humans have redefined intelligence as the antithesis of the things that humans, that machines could do. So once machines could do math, they were like, yeah, but math isn't really what's smart, it's this other thing. And then when machines could do drive cars, it's going to be, that's not really what's intelligence, it's this other thing. And we're eventually going to get backed into a corner where, you know, it's going to be hard to understand what is really the difference between this AI system and humans. And some people in the AI community, and I think this is a legitimate argument, is at some point, we might have to ask questions about what are the rights of these AI systems if they really do start recapitulating sentience and all of that fun stuff. But the calculator one, I think, is such a salient example because, such a simple piece of technology can blow us away at various intellectual tasks. But we know it doesn't capture something in its entirety. And that problem is the same problem we see with ChatGPT. It's just harder to see. But ChatGPT, just like a calculator, performs really well on various tasks. But if we look under the hood, we know it's still missing something. And that thing that it's missing, we see in the evolution of the brain. These are things that emerge in early mammals and primates. And has real-world implications for how we're going to use these systems in mental health applications, medical applications, customer service applications. These things it's missing really does matter. It would be akin to asking a calculator to derive a new proof. You know, like it does math really well, but we know it can't do that well. It's important to understand the limitations when we apply these systems.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Max S. Bennett about his book called A Brief History of Intelligence, Evolution, AI, and the Five Breakthroughs That Made Our Brains. I knew we would get caught up in all that we've explored already. I have no regrets, but we have a whole lot of other matters to cover in terms of the rest of your book beyond the intriguing introduction. Your book is actually, more than anything, the 4 billion year history of how the human brain came to be. And we're going to be talking briefly, I'm afraid, about kind of the five breakthroughs that you see in the development of the human brain over millions of years. One thing you say that I think is a bit related is that you call this, meaning your book and the central story of it, a human-centered story. But you call on the reader, all of us, to avoid what you call human chauvinism. Explain what you mean by human chauvinism and why you think that's a problem that we should really work hard to avoid.
Mm-hmm. So when there's a easy misconception that can happen when telling a story from past to future, because what we're going to see, or what one sees when someone follows the story of how our brain came to be, we're going to see that our intellectual faculties became more complex and more powerful over time. And there are modern animals that we will use in this story who are good model animals for our ancestors. So for example, I cite a lot of research on rats as evidence for the intellectual faculties of our mammal ancestors from about 100 million years ago. I cite a lot of evidence from certain fish as to the intellectual faculties that were present in our vertebrate ancestor about 500 million years ago. But a common mistake would be to say, okay, well, fish are dumber than all rats, which are dumber than all monkeys, which are dumber than all humans. And that is not the case, because there are independent lineages that got smart on their own, and they are not representative of what our ancestors were, but they have their own storied path of how they got smart. So as an example here, flight, wings, independently evolved 3 times. So insects evolved wings on their own, bats evolved wings on their own, and birds evolved wings on their own. The ancestor of these three animals did not have wings. And so the story of how insects got wings is very different than the other two examples. But it's not, when you go back in time, it's easy to confuse saying, oh, well, because the fundamental issue is if you look at like an octopus, for example, an octopus got really, really smart on its own, but the ancestor of humans and octopi was actually quite dumb. And so I just want to avoid in the path of getting to humans, us thinking that humans are smarter than all other animals. That would be human chauvinism, because a lot of the feats, for example, that emerged in early mammals actually also emerged in birds and also emerged independently in octopi, the same way wings independently evolved. So to say that early mammals evolved some special ability, like to imagine futures and pasts, is not to say that only mammals can imagine futures and pasts. It's just to say in our lineage, in our story, imagining the future and the past evolved in early mammals. Hmm.
So this sprawling story, which covers, as I said, 4 billion years, involves 5 different breakthroughs. And you tell us at the outset that these breakthroughs have always emerged when they do, in a sense, for a reason. That is, it would be moments when our ancestors were facing severe challenges or of one kind or another, or if they were caught up in what you call a powerful feedback loop. I understood perfectly the first part of what you were saying. I struggled to grasp that second part. Can you just briefly explain what you mean by that and why something like that would have an effect on helping to create or foster one of these breakthroughs?
So I think perhaps there are two really good examples of these feedback loops. So I'll give two of them. One occurred in the Cambrian explosion, which was a little over 550 million years ago, or around 550 million years ago, which is when we see a massive diversification of life forms. If you look at fossil records, it's really hard to find fossils from animal life before this period. You can, but it's hard to find. But Cambrian fossils are all over the world because there's just this massive explosion of life forms. And if you were to be in a submarine, so all life back then lived in the oceans and the seas. There was not life on land. But if you jumped in a submarine and you dived into the deep oceans and you looked around at life in the world of the Cambrian, it would be a kind of scary zoo because it was filled with the ancestors of arthropods, which were like massive, the ancestors of insects and crustaceans, which is broadly the group called arthropods. And they were these huge, like insect-like beasts that would grow up to the size of humans. And it was this predatory arms race that emerged between these arthropods and between arthropods and vertebrates. So the arms race, which is this feedback loop, is for every improvement in a predator's ability to detect prey. In other words, to find them, to see them at a distance, to move fast towards them, to trick them, put more pressure on the prey to get better at avoiding the predator, to get better at moving fast away, to detect them faster, to remember the tricks they did. Every improvement in a prey's ability to do so put more pressure on the predator to get even better at finding them early, moving even faster, tricking them even better. Mm-hmm. And so this is a feedback loop where as prey got better, it put more pressure on predators, which made predators better, which put more pressure on prey. And so there's broad agreement that the Cambrian explosion was caused by this predator-prey feedback loop, which of course, many species were both predator and prey. They were caught within a hierarchy of the food chain. And so this just led to this massive diversification. Our ancestors were actually very, very low in this food chain. We were, the top of the food chain were these massive insect-like underwater beasts. We were tiny 2-inch long fish, the first vertebrates, that got really good at moving fast and dashing away from predators and fed on really, really tiny multicellular organisms. But that's one feedback loop. And from that feedback loop grew the very basics of our brain template. So when you look into a fish, all the basics of a fish brain, which is mind-blowing to me at least, all the basics of the human brain are found in a fish brain. And they have the same basic structure, the same basic interrelationships between brain systems. And so as much as we like to think of fish as relatively dumb creatures, they're actually much smarter than we give them credit for. And the basics of pattern recognition, of learning through trial and error, of navigating spatial environments, of remembering locations in space, these things are really incredible feats that evolution stumbled on, all emerged from this predator-prey feedback loop in the ancestors, vertebrate ancestors. That's one feedback loop. Roll the clock forward to about 15 million years ago, so a long time forward. Our ancestors were most akin to modern monkeys. These were the first primates. And a very, very different feedback loop emerged there, where if you look at primate societies, so primates primarily live in groups. There's different types of primate groups, but all of them, or many of them, are very hierarchical. So if you look at, for example, the mating, and you look at the different males in a chimpanzee troop, for example, and you track how many of the children are fathered by a given male, there's a very clear hierarchy. There's a top male that does the majority of the mating. They get first pick of food. The second in command gets probably half or less. The third gets a fraction, and then it trails off dramatically. So there's very strict hierarchies of access to mates, access to food. You can see primates bow to each other. There's clear hierarchies. One of my favorite examples of hierarchies is if you take so there's clear submission and submission noises that monkeys make to each other. And so you can take the hierarchy that you observe in a monkey group, and you can take loudspeakers in the distance, and you can play a dominant noise from any monkey in the group, followed by a submission noise by any monkey in the group ranked below that monkey. And if you do that, the monkey troop doesn't even look over, because there's nothing surprising about a dominant monkey making a dominant noise and then a submissive monkey making a submissive noise. But if you flip it, if you make a monkey ranked higher in the society make a submissive noise to a lower ranking monkey, every monkey in the group all of a sudden looks over in the direction that you played these two noises from the loudspeaker, because they go, oh my God, was there just a dominance reversal? It's like, you know, in, you know, the misery of being in middle school and all these social ranks, it'd be like the nerd saying something really aggressive to, right? Honestly, middle school is like early primate societies.
Right.
And so there's these really powerful social groups in early primates. And what's really interesting is how you get to be the top ranked monkey. In most mammal societies, it's very simple. It's the most powerful member of the group, the strongest, the most aggressive, that becomes the top ranked. But that's not how it is in primate societies. Primate societies are very political. So there's a whole sort of ecosystem of gift giving. So gifting being grooming. So they will groom each other, which is sort of picking termites out of each other's hair, which has been proven to not be hygienic. It's primarily a social exercise in showing affiliation and building alliances. And so it's the primates that are the best at building alliances with each other and cozying up to up-and-coming members of the group and becoming friends with sort of families that are ranked highly in the society that do well. And so this created a feedback loop of social intelligence, which is the better prepared you are as an individual monkey to cozy up to the right people, to make sure you're managing your relationships well, the higher you're going to climb in this primate society. And the better you get at cozying up to the right people, the more pressure it puts on other primates to do the same. And so that created this feedback loop of social intelligence. The fundamental intellectual ability that emerged here is something I call mentalizing, which is not a new word I invented, which is the ability of theory of mind, which is something we see in many primates, the ability to think about someone else's thinking. And the only way you can decide who you're going to cozy up to in a primate society is to think about how is this person going to react if I do something nice for them? And how are other people going to think about me if I cozy up to person A, B, and C? And how best do I cozy up to person A, B, and C? And that all requires thinking about other people's thinking. And so our ability to mentalize and think about the thinking of other grew out of this feedback loop of social competition amongst monkeys. So that's another example of a feedback loop.
And I should think that when we're in the realm of artificial intelligence, and if artificial intelligence is at least in part about trying to pattern this new technology after actual human intelligence, this is probably one of the trickiest matters, or I'm guessing it is, and probably something that gets missed in the mix, this notion of mentalizing that most of us who do it all day have never even really stopped to think about.
100%. I think one of the most critical things missing right now are these systems' ability to reason about human motivations and feelings. And this is such a crucial thing missing. Nick Bostrom's famous book, Superintelligence, he has a really wonderful allegory about this, where he says, let's imagine a future where we have all these super intelligent AI systems, and let's imagine we give one of them control over a paperclip factory. And we just give this AI system a very simple command. So we just say, hey, can you just maximize the production of paperclips? Just do the best job you can managing this factory. And then in this allegory, 2 days later, some number of days later, all of Earth is converted into paperclips. And the point of that allegory is an AI system does not have to be intentionally nefarious. It does not have to want to do harm for it to be really dangerous. All that happened was it misunderstood our command. When we said maximize the production of paperclips, obviously we did not mean turn Earth into paperclips. While humans can do that effortlessly, an AI system doesn't necessarily understand that we would, of course, not want that, because what we said was explicitly maximize production of paperclips. And so this ability emerges from mentalizing. When we say things to each other or we give requests or commands to each other, our ability to understand what the other one actually meant is the same neural machinery that enables us to pause and put ourselves in their shoes and to think about how they would feel if you did certain things. And that's how it's so easy for us to infer what we really mean by the words that we say. And we're constantly doing this as we're using language to each other. And this is something really missing in AI systems, and to potentially catastrophic consequences, because if we start giving them commands and they don't do a good job of inferring, well, what is this human that I'm trying to help actually mean by what they're asking me to do, then we risk them making really bad mistakes. And this is a primate ability that's evolved very explicitly in evolution. And the neural machinery to it is really fascinating. The story by which how it merged is really interesting. And I do think the AI community should, you know, learn more from how brains pull this off.
Right. And of course, whether or not one is even interested in AI itself, just this coming to a better understanding of our own intelligence, the nature of our intelligence, is fascinating and valuable in and of itself. The book, again, is A Brief History of Intelligence, Evolution, AI, and the Five Breakthroughs That Made Our Brains, published by Mariner Books and the author, Max S. Bennett. Max Bennett, I have thoroughly enjoyed exploring your book and this conversation about it as well. Thank you so much and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Monday on the morning show, Rick Beyer, co-author of a fascinating new book called The Ghost Army of World War II, How One Top Secret Unit Deceived the Enemy with Inflatable Tanks, Sound Effects, and Other Audacious Fakery. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sunshine this morning, but a few increasing clouds over the course of the day, and our high just 44 degrees. Cloudy overnight with a low of 31. Tomorrow should be sunny with a high of 47 degrees, and it looks like we will have skies remaining sunny on Sunday and into the early next week, along with a warming trend. We may see some 60s at some point early next week. It is exactly 9 o'clock, and you're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.